The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian with me, Alex Krotowski. This week, it's the end of an era. After 7.5 years, it's my final Tech Weekly. Yes, dear listener, after 270-odd podcasts, which feels like a very long time, it's my last program, and it is a long time. Cast your mind back to 2007, and we'd only just received the iPhone. Twitter was but a mere chick, and we all thought our email was safe and secure. Some of our favorite and most used sites and services were fresh young things back then. We'd just been introduced to Google Street View and the iPlayer. Spotify was yet to come. And so we thought we'd take my final episode, my last hurrah, as an opportunity to hop into the time machine and see what's changed in the time that the Tech Weekly pods have been cast. I'll be joined by the creme of Guardian Tech, Jemima Kish, Alex Hearn, Samuel Gibbs, and Keith Stewart, to pick out the notable moments from our archive. So keep listening as we step back in time. This really is going to be one to remember. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. So then, before we begin my last show, let's spin back to hear what was in the first. Hello and welcome to the first Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and joining me to make heads and tails of the world of technology are Jemima Kish, Bobby Johnson, and Charles Arthur, each members of the underground digital elite. We are laying the foundation for the future of this podcast, ensuring that everyone is on the same digital page as we move forward in our journey through the bits and bytes of the matrix. Welcome to the 2007 Technology Review. Over the next 20 or so minutes, we'll rush you through the highs and the lows, the peaks and the pitfalls of this year in gadgetry, including the skinny on the iPhone, the state of the Facebook nation, the games that made a difference, and what technology did for the world. Let's start out with the shiniest gadget of the decade, the iPhone.
And this is the home screen of iPhone right here. And so if I want to get in the iPod, I just go down that lower right-hand corner and push this icon right here, and boom, I'm in the iPod.
Well, some visionary thoughts from your Tech Weekly team here in our review of 2007 and our very first program. And we start this week by looking at some of the developments of the big themes in technology, gaming, and the web since then. As you heard there, mobile and the launch of the iPhone was a big thing back in 2007. And it's fair to say that the launch of this device has had a massive impact on all corners of the tech industry. Jemima, it's only appropriate to throw this one to you because actually I understand we have an iPhone 1 downstairs on the tech desk.
Yeah, I found it the other day. In my box of snakes, there was just the odd device, and most of the others I'd got rid of, a kind of an old Nokia phone and an old Sony Ericsson, because remember when those were the only decently designed mobiles you could get?
Yeah, of course. And the iPhone sort of swoops in and literally changed the game, didn't it?
Yeah, it looks kind of lozenge-y when you look back at it now. It feels incredibly small, but it's still a really kind of attractive device. And it's quite funny to put it next to a 6. But yes, at the time, it was completely groundbreaking. There were other phones that had some of those features, but they integrated them better than any device at the time.
Keith, the iPhone was actually a game changer, not just for mobile communications, but also for gaming. It ushered gaming in to the mobile industry, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there had been mobile gaming before that, but the problem was that the handsets that were around at that time were incredibly fragmented. There were lots of different ones. You know, every manufacturer brought out a very different phone with very different feature sets. And the platforms they were running games on, things like Java, weren't particularly capable with sort of higher end games. So it was a very fragmented market. And there was no very good, reliable way to buy games either. The mobile phone operators had their own app stores. The phone handset makers had their own app stores. It was very confusing and very expensive. And so kind of what the iPhone did was make that all really, really simple. One platform for developers, which was really powerful, and one place to buy your games, which was the app store. So yeah, I mean, it turned mobile gaming into a sort of a side division of the mobile technology space into, you know, a major focal point.
Alex?
I mean, I think it's quite interesting that Jemima was saying that it came along and changed the game instantly, because that's certainly how I felt. But I know that Sam at the time reacted to the launch of the new iPhone with sort of a massive shrug and a raised eyebrow. The tech specs weren't there.
Cynical.
Well, you know, I mean, in the US, Edge, which is what the first iPhone ran on, was a thing. Here, we'd completely skipped it. We went from GPRS to 3G. We were rocking 3G, man. That was at least twice, maybe even four times as fast. And then somebody from America decided they wanted to sell me a phone on Edge. No, I'll stick with my Nokia. Thank you very much.
Well, speaking of technologies that leapfrogged other technologies and then left others flailing around in the box of snakes, PCs. For a while in 2011, HP were talking about stopping making PCs. Sam, that's pretty revolutionary. No PCs? What will the world do?
Well, nobody can make money. And to be fair, we're in a similar game today. The only people who can make money are seemingly Apple and a few people who sell vast volumes to enterprise.
Really, the big thing that's hovering over all of that is the existence of the tablet. 2010 was the introduction of the iPad. And for that first year, it looked likely that the iPad would just dominate everything. Even when, as with the iPhone, the first iPad was underpowered, it didn't have enough RAM, it was clearly a Generation 1 product. The sales of it were astronomical. By the time the iPad 2 came out in 2011, they only grew higher. And for a while, it really did look like this wasn't just going to be a strong new product category, but that it was just going to completely usurp PCs as a thing entirely.
Well, speaking of tablets, the other thing that was quite big back in the day in 2008 were netbooks. Where are they? Because there are still Chromebooks and things like that. So some people do engage with them.
Yeah, I mean, what happened with netbooks is they lost the keyboard and gained a touchscreen. And the iPad, the first iPad when it came out, people before it was even announced were hypothetically pricing it at $1,000. And it came out at half that, $500. And it came out at a price point that could compete favorably with something like an Asus EPC, which was, you know, the big popular netbook at the time. And that EPC didn't sell because it was pleasant to type on. It sold because it was cheap and tiny. And the iPad was that, but actually nice to use as well. And that basically killed netbooks overnight. Instantly, the only reason why you would buy a laptop over an iPad was if you needed those laptopy things like a big screen and a keyboard. Otherwise, you would just buy a tablet.
And in fact, that seems to be a fascinating generational thing in which the youth these days are not using laptops, they're using phones. Well, moving on. Speaking of devices, let's look at gaming. The gaming world was the same, but different in 2007. Keith, the PS3, the Xbox 360, and the Wii were all in their prime. But can it be right that 8 years later we're a generation on?
It's funny because lots of the things that are sort of big now were only just kind of emerging in 2007. And obviously we've talked about mobile games there, but something else really important for mainstream video games happened in 2007, and that was the arrival of Call of Duty Modern Warfare. Which went on to become the biggest series. Call of Duty had been kind of reasonably big until that point, but Call of Duty Modern Warfare by Infinity Ward really kind of projected this very gung-ho military shooter into the sort of big leagues of the entertainment industry. You know, the Call of Duty brand became bigger than any Hollywood motion picture. So, you know, that was a big thing that happened. And after that, we got a series of very big blockbuster action adventure games. This was very much the period in which games kind of really discovered how to be cinematic, you know, for good or for bad, really, because, you know, what we saw were lots of games that ape the style and the graphical impacts of cinema, but without, you know, lost some of the interactivity. So we had big games like the Uncharted series, which looked absolutely beautiful, but lots of people kind of criticized for just being sort of glorified cinema. I think another thing that this period has showed us that even though we still have the same consoles, the people making the games are very different. I think 2007 was just about the period where Japan was kind of losing its way as a development force in the industry. It used to be that, you know, on the PlayStation 2 and PlayStation 1 and Saturn, it was Japanese games. The companies like Konami, Capcom, Sony, Nintendo, that really kind of dominated the market with games like Resident Evil and Ridge Racer. But I think from 2000 onwards, we saw that shifting, you know, and especially with the big Grand Theft Auto titles, Grand Theft Auto 4 and 5, we saw a massive shift towards open world experiences away from the kind of regimented form and kind of weird offbeat themes of Japanese games. So, and, you know, we saw the rise of things like Assassin's Creed.
And also around 2009, which was when I stopped writing for the games blog, another Guardian property, that which is where we both cut our teeth, Keith. around that time, social gaming started to evolve, didn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, this did two really, really important things. The ability to distribute games for free on Facebook as a platform meant that you got lots of new people playing and sharing games as well. So it wasn't about console gamers or PC gamers anymore. It was about anybody that had a PC, anybody that had a laptop could share games with their friends. And very quickly, the smartest companies realized that actually the most important thing was going to be eyes, was going to be about gaining users rather than monetizing everything. So we got the arrival of the whole freemium concept. So games would be free, but players could buy tokens in order to customize or change in-game elements. And so it was a whole different approach to game design. So we got big companies arriving like Zynga with its Farmville series, which is very much based on give the game away for free, encourage people to share the elements of the game so that the thing could propagate.
And in its own way, that was also the rise of sort of an increasing level of really nastiness on the part of game publishers, wasn't it? Because like Farmville and Zynga's, the attempts to bring people's friends in and to get them to share and basically bring new addicts in, it's a real harbinger of the ghastly free-to-play mechanics which now rule on a lot of game stores.
Yeah, I mean, there was definitely a certain amount of cynicism there. And I think, you know, you looked at Zynga as a company and realized that a lot of its development workforce were actually data harvesters. They were people who were designed to study the metrics, work out exactly where players were dropping out of their games and tweaking them accordingly into these kind of very finely tuned machines of compulsion. And that's always been an element of game design. But of course, in the past, game designers, once you paid £50 for your disc, that was it, you were sold. They didn't really have to, you know, they didn't have to do anything after that to attain and keep your interest. Whereas companies like Zynga with Farmville had to iterate and had to be really kind of psychologically manipulative in some ways to keep people playing and keep people sharing. So yeah, I mean, the free-to-play in the early days was a really kind of quite cutthroat industry where play-to-win dynamics were probably more common than they are today. I think the whole thing has kind of refined slightly since those days, but that was where it was all born, definitely.
Finely tuned machines of compulsion. That's going to be my next bandman. And speaking of bands, elsewhere in digital media, the landscape has completely changed over the last 8 years. As we mentioned earlier, Spotify was not with us at that point. Just a twinkle in its eye. But its launch has changed the way we listen to music yet again. The iPlayer was unveiled just as the show began. And now people are beginning to cut the cord for their traditional satellite and cable subscriptions and look to the internet for their entertainment, whether it's YouTube, Netflix, Amazon Instant. Jemima, the iPod was absolutely at an all-time high.
2007, probably the debate for the music industry was very much, oh, should we or shouldn't we go with iTunes, and Apple was a threat. But that was a really solid, legitimate business model. So what's the alternative to that? It's just that if people want your stuff online, then they'd go and get it from, you know, Napster or Pirate Bay or wherever. The most significant shift since then has been streaming, of course, because connectivity is so much better these days. So I suppose the discussion for the industry moved on to, should we allow our musicians' work to be available on Spotify? And now it looks like the cycle is sort of going to be completed, because Apple is working, we think, on a proposition that will compete more directly with Spotify. Alex might want to talk about Taylor Swift as an example of an artist who has...
Has he turned red, or is that just...
He's a little flush.
Why would I turn red?
No idea. So we're sort of almost seeing things come full circle, but we did very much in 2007 need to see the industry embrace the potential of online, legitimate online delivery.
And actually streaming, Sam, you were saying that today, of all days, there has been an announcement.
Yeah, in fact, Warner announced that this quarter, 2015 first quarter, they have earned more money from streaming than they have from downloads, which is the first time ever.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, so I mean, if you didn't take downloads seriously and then you didn't take streaming seriously,
then I'm not betting on anything that you say ever again. Video, YouTube, growing emphasis on channels. What has happened with YouTube over the last 8 years has been pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what we've seen is YouTube going from being a video sharing website, a place where you would go to sort of upload a video and share it in the sort of way that people use Imgur now, to a destination in its own right. It's no longer you go to YouTube to view a video, and by you, I specifically mean, I guess, people under 21. You don't go to YouTube.
That's not us, though.
Definitely yeah. Me. Absolutely me.
One, and a significant portion of YouTube's users, crucially, don't go to YouTube the way we all did 6 or 7 years ago, and the way most people who aren't in this group still do now, to go essentially, oh, there was a really funny video I saw a while ago that I want to show you. It's you go and you have people who you watch every video of. You watch the uploads. You keep track of everything that your favorite Minecraft player or Dota streamer does. You watch it, and it's a destination in its own right. It's finally achieving this thing that traditional media companies have feared for the better part of the last decade, of replacing television.
Do you think, though, that traditional media companies are aware of the threat? Because if I speak with traditional media companies, many of them have never heard of PewDiePie, Zoella, and any of the enormous, I mean, phenomenally huge celebs.
I know that they're aware of the threat, but they're aware of the threat in the abstract sense. They know of it as YouTube. And the problem is, of course, if you know that YouTube is stealing your audience, that leaves you with absolutely no information, because you can't go and hire YouTube to make shows for your TV channel. A few of the smarter people, not really in the traditional channels, but at least in the hub of old media, are making the most of it. Hulu, the American video on demand service, has started poaching some of the top YouTubers, because fundamentally YouTube is now stuck in this awkward position as a subsidiary of Google, of straddling its old goal of providing a place for people to store and share uploaded video with its new goal of being a media company which commissions content. Right now, if you're big enough to get an upfront fee and production budget, you've got a lot of options other than YouTube, and it's not really offering people a huge reason to stick around.
Jemima.
And arguably, Google/YouTube has done very little with the phenomenal success of some of the artists on YouTube, which they're not really branded, there isn't really an identity there, the comment stream is awful, there's very little community around that. But, you know, maybe that's the opportunity for old media that they still need to run in and seize before somebody very clever does do something with it.
Before we move into the next section, one part of the digital world that's kept us on our toes over the last 8 years has been social media.
There are now hundreds of thousands of developers building on Facebook's tools, including more than half outside of the U.S. Last year, we drove more than 3.5 billion app installs. People shared more than 50 billion pieces of content from apps that they're using to their friends on Facebook. We've paid out more than $8 billion to developers in the last 5 years. Because of all the apps and services that you're all building, the Facebook ecosystem is stronger than ever.
We've hopped from one network to the next as the various services have come and gone. Friendster, Orkut, Bebo, we are now no longer your followers. But since 2007, we've seen the continued rise of Facebook. Twitter has spread its wings too, and Google Plus hasn't really had a plus one from anyone for a long time. Jemima, I remember you were basically our in-house MySpace correspondent in 2007.
Ah, I know, it was for sins of a past life. Well, of course, the big thing to talk about here is Facebook. It was in September 2006 that it opened up to the world outside the higher education world in the US. And I remember going to a conference in San Francisco in September 2007, and there was this young, shiny, fresh-faced guy called Mark Zuckerberg being interviewed on stage. Who could have predicted the scale? Last time I checked, it was 1.36 million users. Billion.
It's been a while since you checked, hasn't it?
What's a billion between friends? But think about the kind of cultural impact of Facebook on our sensibility of how we engage and how we identify ourselves in the wider world. There was a huge outrage when Facebook developed the news feed. So that was just sharing very innocuous bits of information about you with your friends. Huge outrage about it. It was outrageous, an invasion of our privacy. Think about how much the information that we share and how little we consider it in that time. It was very much about throwing sheep. Do you remember that on Facebook? Throwing sheep
zombies,
and poking people and funny little silly games.
Can you still throw sheep on Facebook?
I don't think so. But if you can...
You can still poke. I got poked the other day.
Don't ever look in the second inbox. You know, there's the one inbox and then there's the other inbox. If you look in there, it's all gentlemen offering marriage, which is kind, but I'm already married.
It's very gentlemanly of you. So, Sam, could you have predicted? I mean, if you had been sitting around the table in 2007, would you have said, you see that thing, the one with the really bad design and the totally unpersonalizable background? That's going to be massive.
Well, yes, because I'd been using it in university before it was opened to the wider world. And basically, if you weren't on there, you didn't get to go to parties or anything. I mean, it was just like, that was it. And I could see it worked amazingly well. But then we were kind of outraged that other people can come on here. What?
It wasn't one of the worst design, though, actually, because it was very, very clean. It was very well engineered. It was just that you were so used to being able to paste HTML into the about field of your MySpace profile and customize it.
My eyes are blinking. I'm having flashbacks from going onto MySpace and things assaulting my senses.
Alex, did you even have a MySpace page?
I did have a MySpace page. I was also the snotty teen who made all my friends get on Facebook quite rapidly because I was sick and tired of their awful custom CMS crashing my browser.
There
was one person who I unfriended on my, or unfollowed, or whatever MySpace's verb was, on MySpace because I couldn't load his page. Whatever he was using simply would not work on my computer. So that was it. Cut off from my digital life.
You're dead to me.
So, Keith, we talked about throwing sheep and poking and zombies, but we haven't talked about the other very important aspect. The crack cocaine of Facebook isn't just the status updates. It's actually the social gaming. It's embedding the games inside the social network. That's pretty revolutionary. Finally, a place where everybody could go and I don't know, exchange candy and farm animals.
Yeah, and I think... introducing that kind of social gaming element was really important. The idea that there was value in being able to share in-game items, which is what games like Farmville brought in, then kind of propagated outwards to the rest of the games industry. So when you saw later iterations of Xbox Live and PlayStation Network, they had all of these social elements built in. They had Facebook connectivity, Twitter connectivity, and you had games like Need for Speed Hot Pursuit that came out, which is a racing game where you could race over a certain part of the track and it would trigger and let you know that a friend had raced over that same part slightly faster than you and would show you their times, and you could go back and try that race again. This was a really important innovation. It changed our idea of how multiplayer worked. In the past, it was always about everybody in the same room together playing a game, or everybody online together playing a game. But what mainstream game designers learned from Facebook was this idea of asynchronous multiplayer. So you could be playing a level, but then you could see what your friend's score was like on that, or see how fast your friend was, or how many people he'd shot in the face. And so you could compare and contrast and create these kind of rivalries. And it meant that everybody didn't have to be online at the same time. I think one of the things that game designers really learned from Facebook is that actually for a lot of us, our social lives are asynchronous now. You know, we go onto Facebook because we can't see our friends. Sometimes they're on the other side of the planet. Sometimes they're just too busy. So it's getting harder in our kind of crazy, hectic world to meet up with people. So Facebook really kind of allowed us to explore this idea of sharing game experiences, but in a very different way and not necessarily together at the same time.
And it wasn't just about the sort of the gaming in that regard, but it was also about social play. And we've seen, although they existed before, Sam, we've seen the kind of rise of a weird identity shift and trolling and people being really burnt on this kind of thing, on sort of losing themselves to social media. How have we gone in the last 8 years? What has been our evolution from, oh, this is a really neat thing, we're going to share everything, to being much more sort of reflective on our lives online?
Well, you mean, it's funny, I remember when I first got on Facebook, it was just literally just a representation of me. That's how I was. This is it. But then it became almost a competition. Who was the best? Who had the best life? Who had the best photos? Who looked the best? I mean, the invasion of the selfie, for goodness sake. Where did that come from?
It wasn't called the selfie for anything.
But I don't think that's a conscious
profile
thing. I think people are almost unaware of the extent to which they self-select. I mean, people will already have written theses on this, Alex.
I don't know what you're talking about. In the course of
people
Tech Weekly,
I managed to get a PhD. People are just enormously self-selective of the stuff, the way in which they represent themselves online, and also the people that they choose to interact with.
And I think that kind of drove both a positive and a negative effect. I mean, we had people that were this new social interaction both allowed them to be very personal and present the best of them, but also allowed them to go anonymous and take the darker side of the internet, which is where trolling came from. The ability to basically tread on someone else, someone crush somebody else's dreams.
In a very public way.
Yeah, and without much of a repercussion. Mm.
Well, speaking of not much of a repercussion.
Beautifully segued.
Thank you. That last point does tie in very nicely to our look back to Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA in 2013, still going strong. It's amazing to think that in less than 2 years ago, since the former systems administrator at the CIA leaked information that revealed the security services have been gathering our telephone and internet histories. Since then, much more has been revealed and has caused many of us to consider our own online privacy. Jemima, have you changed what you do in light of the NSA revelations?
Yeah, so me, along with lots of the other journalists in the building, were taken through some really quite basic security. I don't know the extent to which you want to be kind of paranoid about surveillance, but it should be a matter of course that we encrypt everything that we do and just assume somebody is reading it.
Alex, has your behavior online changed?
You know what? It hasn't anywhere near enough. This is the big problem. Jemima's right. It should be that we encrypt as a matter of course and assume that everyone's reading it, if for no other reason than I think there's a big civil responsibility on everyone's part to encrypt normal traffic so that that rare leaker doesn't stand out purely by virtue of just being the only person who's using encryption. At the same time, I don't use PGP for every email I send because it's a real faff. I rely on the few companies I do use that have end-to-end encryption that's done easily, using services like iMessage and WhatsApp. That's nice, but I still haven't reached the point of actively switching away from services that don't. The one big change I've made is now my hard drive on my MacBook is encrypted, but even that actually was done by default in Mac OS 10.9.
Sam, any big changes for you?
Well, I mean, I began by adopting services that did do end-to-end encryption, and then more and more have done so, I've become more lax and more lax. But I kind of, I've always suspected everyone was reading everything.
Well, yeah, if you'd read Snow Crash, then you would have known that, right? I mean, if you'd read any science fiction cyberpunk, you would have known, of course, everybody's reading the stuff.
I think, of course, Sumerian phenomes can program the operating system of the brain. Of Neil Stevenson was right.
That's correct.
I mean, I think it was a bit bigger of a shock in the US than it was in the UK because, I have the feeling I'm being watched all day, every day, because you step outside and there's 15,000 security cameras looking at you. And I took the same approach to the web.
Keith, how much has your behavior changed since the Snowden revelations?
I think, like everyone else, probably not as much. You know, every day you're weighing with technology, you're weighing up convenience versus security. And I think what changed my behavior mostly was in January when I had my laptop stolen, and I suddenly realized how open a lot of my stuff was. And how vulnerable I was. And I think that was the greatest thing. I think the problem is we do kind of slip into these modes of thought with technology that we just want efficiency. And I think this is the fundamental thing that's maybe happened over the last sort of 7 or 8 years, and what Facebook has done is put us into a position where we're very lax and very lackadaisical about our own sense of privacy and security. And I think that's really fascinating, and I kind of wonder where that's going to go. But for me, yeah, having my laptop stolen was the biggest wake-up call I possibly could have had.
Well, thank you very much all, and you can listen back to the full archive of programs from the last 8 years at theguardian.co.uk/techweekly.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Now, as well as covering the big developments in technology over the last 8 years, invited many guests to join us in the studio, we've broken out and toured the country and have been sticking our microphones into the dark corners of tech to find out what interesting things have been going on. So Jemima is here to take me on a trip back down memory lane to some of my highlights.
Yes, Alex, we're going to start with one of your favourite moments, your research trip to America in 2013. You were experimenting with the hot technology of the 1970s, a CB radio, and found many parallels between that and the online world.
You're very good at that, Jemima.
The same fears that people have about the web now, that it's ruining society, that it's upheaving social norms, that anonymity brings out the worst in people, were exactly the same fears that people had about the CB radio. Specifically, people were terrified of anonymity and how quickly the airwaves turned blue. I should have known it wouldn't be as easy as switching on the thing and announcing myself as Footloose and Limey. The helpful man at the shop, the second shop we visited on our quest to track down the machine, had to root around in the storage room for quite some time before he returned with a dust-covered box that looked like it had been battered by 2 decades of shelf shifting. Despite some early wins on the Cross Bronx Expressway on the way out of Manhattan, when a couple of truckers with pronouncedly colorful language complained at length about the state of traffic and how they'd fix it if they were in charge, the next 2,000 miles, we heard nothing but silence. We tried everything. We read up on the best way to use the CB, which channels to listen to. We reached for it any time we saw more than 2 trucks driving side by side. We even considered getting a kicker, an antenna device that would boost our signal. Nothing. Nothing at all. Until we hit Milan, New Mexico.
In 2011, Dr. Kotowski rounded up the digital world's brightest and best for a series of discussions with government ministers about Tech City. The initiative was to promote the East End of London as a place where technology companies could thrive and flourish. In one episode, Young Rewired State's Emma Mulqueeney spelt out to Universities and Science Minister David Willetts what the industry was like for young coders.
Going back to the, we can't find the kids, that's because they're going to the States. And, what I found, and I've been quite surprised by, is that British industry are not tearing my hands off to get their hands on these kids. Silicon Valley is. I cannot get anybody in the UK, even if I say, I'm finding our brightest kids that can program. Don't you want them? And no one seems to want them. But Silicon Valley are just like, yes, we want them. We want them out here. We want them at Carnegie Mellon. My top 10 that I can think of are all headed out to the States. So it's not that they're not here. It's just that industry hasn't embraced them and hasn't said, come here, we want you, we want your skills here.
So David Willetts, are the universities in the UK equipped to create these kinds of non-code monkey entrepreneurs? Perhaps with a little bit of monkeyness, but, you know, mostly entrepreneuring. what needs to change at university?
The truth is we can always do better. But what we just heard from Emma was depressing. And that wasn't about universities. That was about the ultimate demand from businesses seeing what the opportunity was. And as Emma was talking, I was so shocked by that. I was thinking, what the hell do we do? Next time I have a meeting of the group I chair on high-performance computing and e-infrastructure, I think we'd better get Emma along. Terrible. We shouldn't be wasting this time. Of course, it's a free world. People should be able to travel to the US, but there should be opportunities for them, and we should bloody well make sure we're not wasting these people. Yeah.
In 2009, Alex left Tech Weekly for 6 months to finish her PhD and become a doctor, and to record a series about the web for BBC Two, Virtual Revolution. When she returned, fellow podders Bobby Johnson and Charles Arthur pressed Alex for a bit more information on making the series.
I was just wondering, who were the surprising people that you talked to? I mean, were there people who had insight that you didn't expect, or that were maybe you expected insight from and didn't get it?
I think there were a couple of people. I think I was most surprised by Jimmy Wales. I had expected there to be fisticuffs because I thought that the two of us were kind of on opposite sides of the information and hierarchy platform. But in fact, we were on the same side, and he fully and openly embraces the fact that, yes, there is hierarchy on Wikipedia. And yes, there has to be hierarchy on the web. Gatekeepers must emerge in order to keep things stable, which is something that I had argued before. And he responded back in a negative. And then the final person that I was probably the most intimidated to meet was Sherry Turkle, who's a professor at MIT, whose research influenced mine quite a bit. And she was different from how I thought.
In what way different?
Her almost 2 decades studying the web has affected how she views community and how she views identity online, which is not opposite, but certainly a lot more conservative than what she had proposed, say, 10, 15 years ago. So that was a real surprise.
Well, that's academics for you.
But these are just a few of the many, many highlights we could have picked out. But I thought we'd end with a side of Alex we rarely get to hear. That may be a good thing. A trip to Glastonbury in 2008 for a PlayStation game tenuously linked to the festival, when I joined her on stage for a bit of karaoke.
Right, so I've got 10 minutes before I have to go on this stage. My nerves have receded, which is probably dangerous, and I've just found Jemima. And this is Jemima.
How are you? I'm cider fueled, is what I am. Are you lovely?
So are you coming on stage with me?
Apparently so. I need to look at the song list.
We're doing Common People by Pop.
No, we can't do that. Yes,
we're doing it.
First up here tonight, Alex and Jemima. Come on.
So, Alex, tell us about your memories of starting the podcast and what maybe you were a little apprehensive about, or what you weren't sure might work.
You're looking at me as if I'm supposed to lead you into something. Do you remember? We were in a very, very small room.
It was a broom cupboard.
It was, and yeah. it was covered in spiking audio foam. First time I'd ever seen audio foam in all my puff. And so I was slightly apprehensive about whether it would work or not.
Personal highlights? Are there any that really stand out as being either brilliant or truly awful?
I liked moving to the new studio.
Yeah?
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, I don't know. What do you want me to say?
Thrilling radio.
I am an eye on the scene.
Of course. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I'm now going to be the worst interviewee ever.
No, that's fine. Yeah. So what then is the future for audio? Here's a question.
Oh.
What is the future for audio? Because it seemed for a while that video was really dominant everywhere and that was all that everyone was talking about. But audio's having a bit of a comeback, isn't it? Especially in the US.
No, it's massive in the US. And it's going to be... I'm going to the US for a year.
Woo!
To sort of observe what is happening in audio over there. Because as you say, it's a totally different landscape. It's really embedded into people's daily practices. So it's, you know, whether it's talk radio on the radio or whether it's digital radio, because now most cars, and the car being the primary technology in the US, have digital radios or have, you know, radios that they can actually download podcasts and stuff. So the podcast scene is phenomenal in the US. So I'm going to be looking at that.
And where will we be able to hear about this? Where can we hear and see and read what you'll be working on?
Oh my God, I don't know. AlexKrutowski.com, I suppose.
Yeah.
I guess, goodness. Or one of the many thousands of Tumblrs that I have. If you can find them all. If you can find a compendium of Alex Krutowski, of my Tumblrs, then congratulations, because I create them like they're going out of fashion. Well, that's it for this week's program. Thank you, Jemima, Keith, Alex. Oh, look at that. Sorry, Sam, you get a kiss as well. And look at that. There's a beautiful bag of flowers and there's cake. So thank you very much, everybody. Yay. I'm going to read this. Wow. That's an extraordinary card. We'll have to put a picture of this up on the Tech Weekly Tech Weekly Twitter feed. The internet, once you post it, that shit stays forever. Wow, that's okay. Well, thank you very much to everybody. It has been an amazing journey. I've learned a hell of a lot, and I know that I can interview politicians with aplomb without falling over, thanks to Tech Weekly.
And eat cake
as well. Yeah. Shoot, I wish I'd known I wouldn't have had a flapjack ahead of time. This has been another episode of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. We welcomed the original producer back into the studio today, Woo! Scott Cawley, to do the program. And I'd also like to give props to Bobby Johnson, who brought me in the first place, who's now in San Francisco, and Charles, who is somewhere, wherever Charles is, who also did a lot of pods with us. So thank you to the audience very much for listening. Let's eat some cake.
Woo!
Oh, God.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.